Over the next couple of weeks, we're going to try and bring you a series on one of the most interesting pastoralists Northern Tableland saw arrive in the region, Algernon Henry Belfield, and his grandson, Richard Belfield, is going to help tell us a story. But joining us along the way is the University of New England archivist, William Oates, and the president of the Armidale and District Historical Society, Judy Greaves. Now, Richard, you start the story for us. He arrived in Australia. What was his early childhood like before coming to Australia?
Well, he was very well educated. He finished his schooling at Rugby. He won a classics prize, which could have taken him on to Oxford. And from there, he could have then gone on to the Inner Temple in London and become another barrister. So there are lawyers in the family, like there were so many in those days. But his father, for reasons I want to go to England and find this out, but his father lost all his money, but he and another man controlled the entire, virtually, sugar industry in Barbados. And as you know, back in that era, sugar was a luxury. So it was, and if you see the homes that they had, they weren't short of money, but the old father lost all that money. And interestingly enough, Algernon never ever went back to the UK, and he could have well afforded to do it, but he never went home. So that's interesting, and I'd love to know why, but I don't.
Richard, you say he came out of steerage. What year was it, and then how did he end up in the Northern Tablelands?
He came to Australia on the 17th of December in 1855, a fortnight before his 17th birthday. Now, he also travelled in steerage as he had absolutely no money. So Algernon then came pretty well to the New England, and he worked for the Marsh Estates at Boorong.
Why do we think Algernon chose this region to come to, Richard?
I think it's through connections in England. I really think that he had a letter of recommendation from something in the UK, and because he came straight here. And I mean to say, this was a long way from Sydney in those days. He could have gone to anywhere else, but he chose here. So I think he came here with absolutely intent.
William, was that a common thing to happen, to have a person settle in a region so far from Sydney?
Frequently in the archival record, you'll see that early landholders of the New England received other family or friends from the United Kingdom bearing letters of introduction. The people doing the immigration would come to Australia. They would have a contact that had been recommended while they were in England. They would then seek out that contact and then find employment or find a recommendation for employment. So you'll find geographical groupings of families in Australia that link back to geographical groupings of families in the United Kingdom as well.
Judy, what were in these letters? What kind of form of words did they contain to persuade someone that this is a good chap and we should give him a chance?
I haven't seen very many of them. I've seen a couple, but they've been more sort of in a local scene. But they were very formal, and they were sort of introducing. It was more, I would like to introduce you to XYZ, who's my good friend or my son, but very formal, and just requesting that this person, if possible, does the right thing by them. But they're mostly ones within Australia. I guess it was a lot more important if you were in Devon and you were coming to Australia to have something that really endeared you to to that person, or that the connections were made very clear that would help that person.
After jackarooing for a while, he became involved with Septimus Hungerford, the Reverend Septimus Hungerford, I think, who at that time was the Bishop of Newcastle. And now, whether Septimus Hungerford or the church, but there was some relationship between them there of where he gained funds. And it's interesting to see that you didn't go to the bank, apparently you went to other people for money. Now, this is family folklore, so this is reputed to be true.
And William, how unusual is it to hear a story like that the church was financing a pastoralist of the time?
It's common to hear about individual members of the clergy being involved in pastoral pursuits, but it's difficult to believe that the church would be out financing landholders. in the early days, they were often given direct land grants for specific purposes or donations from other people.
William, what have you been able to find out about the time from which Richard was saying he got the loan to when he actually started picking up the land?
Once arriving in the New England, he was working as an overseer, and from the time that he worked in an overseer in 1857, he was then able to approach a business partner in the Septimus Hungerford in 1864 to acquire some of the land from where he was already working. So in 1864 he acquires land off Henry Arding Thomas and works that land up until his marriage in 1873. It's noted that by the time of his death he had 19,713 acres.
And Judy, what was life like around that time in Armidale? What was happening already here?
I think it was still a man's world. There was a burgeoning township in Armidale. Apparently it wasn't a very, very salubrious sort of place because there were very few women. And it was tough. You had to wait for any supplies. You had to be fairly self-sufficient. They grew everything they could and produced everything they could for their own survival. It was a tough world.
You're listening to ABC New England Northwest, and we're taking a look at one of the very interesting pastoralists in the early days of Armidale, Algernon Henry Belfield, with his grandson Richard Belfield, UNE archivist William Oates, and Judy Greaves, the president of the Armidale Historical and District Society. And Richard, Judy was just talking about how there weren't many women around at the time. How did Algernon find a bride?
Well, that's interesting. He found a bride in Sydney. And she was a Miss Husband from a well-known Sydney family, and they were married at North Sydney, and he brought his bride up to Eversley, and they lived initially in a slab hut, which apparently was very frugal. Later on, that became a schoolroom, but it was a very simple, humble beginning.
Bill, Richard was saying that he found his bride in Sydney, but he did seem to take a long time to find a bride. Why would there have been such a long time between his arriving in Australia and eventually marrying?
A gentleman had to be a gentleman of money in order to obtain a bride of quality. So I would imagine that in the 18 years between him arriving in Australia and the time that he married, he was actually accumulating the funds where he could have kept a wife in style. Even then, what Richard's saying is quite common, that many of the brides were brought out into the New England and taken to slab huts or bark roof dwellings. And it was only after the calming influence of the bride that more permanent structures were built on these dwellings. You also have to remember that a lot of these early landholdings were leasehold, not freehold, so people didn't invest heavily in buildings until such time as they had a freehold block in order to build more substantial houses on.
Judy, what was life like for young women when they were brought up to the New England in the situation as Algernon's bride was?
It would have been incredibly rough. They had a tiny settlement, but that's all I think Armidale was in. Although Emma came up in the 1870s, things were improving then. Now I come to realise they had little schools. There were more women. They would have had some niceties in life. And Algernon and his wife, I guess, would have mixed occasionally with the other people of some standing in the district. But it wouldn't have been a lot of fun.
Are there many records of the women at the time? Are there many diaries that you've been able to find through the Historical Society?
Not that I can think of offhand. There are some. Mrs. Marsh had a diary. When they had social affairs, they were quite well recorded, but they were few and far between, I think. And women who started to have families, they were completely alone, away from the sort of things that we like to know are close handy to help you with families. But they were tough. They did it tough, and they were prepared to do it. I don't think Emma Husband would have come up here completely unaware of what she was facing. things were improving all the time too.
When did the first child arrive for the newly married couple?
Violet was born on the 22nd of June 1874. Then there was Vere. He was born on the 8th of the 9th, 1875. Philip was born on the 25th of the 7th, 1877. Edgar was born in 1879. Bob was born in 1882. Nora was born on the 10th of the 4th, 1884. Mary, who died as a baby, was born on the 26th of the 11th, 1885. And Margaret, the baby, she was born in 1887.
And what do we know of him as a father? What type of father was he?
Rather interesting. I wonder how many other people would believe this, but the boys, the four boys, after being basically reared by mother, and I don't know what age this happened, they then went to their own brick abode with a nanny, cook, and totally away from the main house, where they ate lunch on Sunday with the family only. That's the only time they were permitted into the homestead. The girls, that they were in a different regime altogether, but that was the boys.
Is that unusual, Judy? Was that happening in a lot of sort of pastoral families at the time?
I don't really know. I find that a little... It was a very... the Victorian era, of course, the parents were very much... separate from their children, but this seems a little extreme to provide them with a completely self-contained accommodation and only meet up on Sunday for dinner. So no, I don't know of other instances quite so extreme.
They actually lived in a lovely brick home. You know, it was nothing untoward at all, but over the road from the main house. So I hear Jude, but that's what happened. Yeah.
He was a very religious man.
A very religious man, yes, he was. He was very mixed up in his church. He was both a lay preacher. He used to go monthly to Little St. Nicholas's Church at Somers Ponds, where he was a lay preacher. He was also thoroughly involved in the diocese, with diocesan things. He was on the board... on the original board of the Armidale School and also an original shareholder.
Where did he send his children to be educated?
Right, well, this is rather interesting because they're scattered about. Vere, he went to the King's School. Then the other three boys, they all went to Taz. And my father actually won the first 100 yards at Taz, but that's by the by. But the girls went to Kambala. So he spread them all over. I don't know why he did that, but that's what he did. But he was... I think we could say that he was terribly keen on education. This pops up right through his life, of even to building a school on Eversley for the families. He did that just because he felt they needed education. And at one stage that school got to almost a bit over 20 pupils. So I think we could say amongst his many interests he was an educator.
Judy, how common was it for the pastorals to send their children to boarding schools in Sydney?
Many of them sent their children back to England, the well-to-do ones, but that was probably more common for a while, and then gradually as private schools in Sydney became more elite, they started to utilise them. And certainly the King's School has Shaw and Kambala and Askham and Frensham, all of those, they had a status very early in the piece, so it was saved them sending them back home to England.
We've kind of looked at the education, the family life. Next week, why don't we have a closer look at his pastoral activities?